Hello and welcome along to the Guardian Haycast. All the best bits with none of the effort. Not that it takes any effort, of course. However, this bank holiday weekend has been a bit of a cultural and political whirlwind with record numbers of people and record amounts of sunshine. Today's programme shows the breadth of the minds converging here, from credit crunch cult hero Robert Peston to Marcus Zusak, author of The Book Thief. And I'll be talking to Fiona Miller about the secret world of working mums. Now, over the last 3 days, the G2 crew have been housed in the Guardian Yurt, inviting the great and the glorious inside to lounge on rugs and talk, all part of their G2 Hay Festival special, which is out today. One permanent fixture has been G2's John Henley, who's been seen stationed on cushions, notepad out, grilling an array of people. John, you barely left this spot.
That's right. It's been a bit of a conveyor belt. 23, 24 people, ranging from Anthony Giddens to Heston Blumenthal to Stephen Daldry, Sandy Toksvig, Steve Jones, Martin Rees, Jane Birkin, David Starkey.
So who are your favourites of all these?
I was actually very fond of the Chapman brothers. They were iconoclastic. They lived up to their bill. They took the piss out of the whole thing and notably said that they felt as if everybody had gone to Glastonbury and left their parents here.
Paddy Ashdown,
he's a great book lover. He's been many times to Hay, and he suggested, on the contrary, that perhaps, you know, one of the best ways to revive our flagging democracy would be to only allow those people to vote who had been at least once in the past year to a literary festival.
Hear, hear. The point surely is that there's such a breadth of speakers that you could come for a week and never once meet a novelist.
Well, that's right, and I didn't, in fact. Well, one, I just met Rebecca Miller, who was absolutely charming and extremely interesting.
So there's politics, science, philosophy, economics?
Yes, economics, that's right. Yes, Robert Peston's been a bit of a hero. I mean, he gave a very well-attended talk, basically about who was to blame for the whole financial stroke economic crisis that we're presently in.
The FSA itself, the city watchdog, spent most of its time looking for crooks, but it didn't spend very much time looking for idiots. And it would have been jolly helpful if it could have spent a bit more time. It believed, I mean, you don't take my word for this, this is actually something that Adair Turner, the chairman of the FSA, has actually said. He said that the FSA had this view that because markets are so perfect and wonderful and efficient, that strategic decisions made by bankers, like buying a bank called ABN at the top of the market before the world's about to fall apart, they couldn't possibly be wrong. So regulators never actually sort of questioned the really big things that these banks did that turned out to be catastrophically stupid.
So tell me, what exactly did Robert get up to in the Yurt?
Ah, well, this was an idea of my colleague Stephen Moss, who printed out a couple of copies of the To Be or Not To Be soliloquy from Hamlet and basically asked him to deliver it in pure 100% Pestonian, which turned out to be extremely amusing. And one of the things that Stephen asked him, in fact, was whether he deliberately ramped up his delivery style to match the urgency of the credit crunch.
People have said that. I mean, you know, I'm an enthusiast, and I do get excited when I'm talking about stuff that I'm excited about.
You seem to pause on the little words, and then the big words, you almost hurry through them. So of seems to be a key word.
I think that's a thinking thing. I just have always done this thing of sort of, you know, thinking and speaking more or less simultaneously, which can mean, so you have to devise strategies to make sure that what comes out isn't completely stupid. Well, occasionally, I guess the pauses go in slightly odd places.
So my boring, unsuccessful monotone, how can I get a more Pestonian delivery?
Got to think, talking to Robert Peston is the most exciting thing I've ever done in my entire career. This could be the biggest moment of your life.
It is. No, in many ways it is.
And, I mean, you know, and, but you're not projecting that.
Okay, can we try the speech?
I've got to read this.
Yeah, I mean, I'll read it the way I'd read it. Okay.
Oh, bloody hell.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die to sleep no more and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. That's the beginning.
Okay.
Can we hear that?
You can.
As Peston on talking to John Humphreys would say it.
To be or not to be,
That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more. And by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, to sleep, perchance to dream. I think we've got enough, haven't we?
That's more than enough, yeah. So it's really the voice has to go up and down, yes?
Yeah, it appears to.
And extending certain words.
I think you've probably got to be completely rubbish at where you put your emphasis. I think
So it's not RADA. It's not the RADA school of...
It certainly isn't. It appears to be the Robert Person eccentric school.
Okay, so give me five tips. Get excited.
The three things you have to do is you have to immerse yourself in the story so that you feel you own it. Okay, and so the journalism does come first. It's about you have to sort of, you know, you have to live the story and you have to feel that the story matters and, you know, you have to feel that you own it. Right? It's your story. It's nobody else's story. Right? Secondly, you have to be clear, and you can't fake this, that the story matters. And then, I guess, you've got to just be unself-conscious, I'm afraid.
But it's a natural thing. You don't deliberately.
No, it's not. I mean, darling, do I sit at home thinking, how can I make myself sound even crazier?
No, he doesn't. I can guarantee that. Nor does he dye his hair, by the way.
Okay, we'll stress that. Yeah. Is that not very exhausting?
No, he's got a normal, perfectly, yeah. I think, perfectly pleasant, normal, I think, personally, rather attractive way of speaking.
Yeah.
A very nice, modulated, well-spoken voice, which his mother was a speech therapist, and his mother's made them all speak very nicely. When he started doing the broadcasting, it baffled me why he suddenly is completely mad, manic delivery, because that is not how he speaks.
Yeah.
And the the boys make fun of a lot.
In the style of your father?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them, to die, to sleep.
Okay, so it's very much your own rhythm. And did it worry you initially, when you had the flak?
No, not really. I mean, I'm incredibly thick-skinned. Oh, well, I put it this way, I'm thick-skinned, I didn't take it personally. If you're a journalist, it's about getting the story and it's about communicating it, and if people were focusing on the method of communication and not on what I was saying, that would have been a bad thing. I mean, honestly, I think if you do look at how I did it initially and how I do it now, honestly, I'm not as crazy as I was when I started.
Hi, my name is Paddy Ashton and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast. My guilty reading pleasure is The Hungry Caterpillar, which I always read to my kids, and I absolutely adore it. I pretend that they love it, but actually I adore it. It's a great piece of writing. It gives a tremendous scope for acting as well.
Hi, I'm Marcus Suzak. You're listening to The Guardian's Haycast. The book felt cool enough to slip inside her uniform. At first, it was nice and warm against her chest. As she began walking, though, it began to heat up again. By the time she made it back to Papa and Wolfgang Erdl, the book was starting to burn her. It seemed to be igniting. Both men looked in her direction. She smiled. Immediately, when the smile shrank from her lips, she could feel something else, or more to the point, someone else. There was no mistaking the watched feeling. It was all over her, and it was confirmed when she dared to face the shadows over at the town hall. To the side of the collection of silhouettes, another one stood a few metres removed, and Liesl realised two things. A few small pieces of recognition. One, the shadow's identity, and two, the fact that it had seen everything. The shadow's hands were in its coat pockets. It had fluffy hair. If it had a face, the expression on it would have been one of injury. God verdammt, Liesl said, only loud enough for herself. God damn it. Are we ready to go? In the previous minutes of stupendous danger, Papa had said goodbye to Wolfgang and was ready to accompany Liesl home. Ready, she answered. They began to leave the scene of the crime, and the book was still well and truly burning her now. The shoulder shrug had applied itself to her ribcage. As they walked past the precarious town hall shadows, the book thief winced. What's wrong? Papa asked. Nothing. Quite a few things, however, were most definitely wrong. Smoke was rising out of Liesl's collar. A necklace of sweat had formed around her throat. Beneath her shirt, a book was eating her up.
Marcus Suzak there, reading from his best-selling novel, The Book Thief. I'm Sarah Crown, The Guardian's online literary editor, and I'm here with Marcus on the grass outside the bookshop at the Hay Festival site, where he's just spent a solid hour signing copies of his book after his event. Marcus, when you were writing The Book Thief, did you have any idea at all of the sort of success it was going to be?
No, I think that's the nice thing, is I thought no one would read it. I thought it'd be my least read book, and it's probably the best way I think of it is that I try to imagine someone selling it to their friend, you know, trying to get them to read it, and the friend says, well, what's it about? And I say, oh, well, it's set in Nazi Germany, it's narrated by death, nearly everyone dies, and it's 580 pages long, you'll love it. You know, it just seems like, I mean, I wouldn't pick it up in a bookshop, so I thought nobody else would. You know, I feel really grateful for what's happened.
So as you say, it's about Nazi Germany, it's set in Nazi Germany, it's narrated by death. These, as you've said, aren't things that are necessarily going to appeal at first glance to people. What was it about the book, do you think, that made people take it to their heart?
I think what got it the attention was death as the narrator. I think it's likely that if I didn't end up sticking with that, because I did try some other options as well, that I probably wouldn't be sitting here now. I mean, that for some reason, that got the book a lot of attention. I think maybe it's also, the book really does mean everything to me. I mean, well, you can't never say everything, but it means a lot to me. And maybe people pick up on that when they read a book like that. And I know I have when I've read other people's books, and you think, you know, this is really something that's, you know, that's really important to that writer.
And why does it mean so much to you? Is it, I gather that your parents, your mother and father are Austrian and German. Was their history in any way involved in your writing of it?
It's one of those things, I think, you hardly imagine yourself talking about, you know, the fact that you love your parents. And it's one of those things I practically never tell my parents that I love them, you know, and so maybe this book was my way of doing that. And so it's as, maybe as simple as that, that I really do, like, love my parents and like them and kind of like hearing their stories. Like, I love when my parents tell stories. And I think it's because of them that I became a writer, because they were able to do that. And, you know, sometimes you meet people, you know, and people will say, you've got to meet that person. They've had the most ridiculously amazing life, and they bore you within 2 minutes because they just can't tell stories. Whereas my parents had amazing lives, but the ability to tell those stories really well.
And so did any of their stories, the stories that they told you about their lives when you were little, they made it into this book?
Yeah, I mean, little things and big ones. Like my dad's father, for example, in the First World War, his life was saved by the fact that he had neat handwriting, that a captain came in while they were all just waiting on a hill to go into battle and said, who's got neat handwriting? You know, and it turned out that he did, and he wrote letters that day while the rest of them went over the hill, and none of them came back.
And that story crops up in the book as part of the story of Hans, who is Liesel, the book thief's foster father. Their relationship is really sort of special and beautifully drawn. They're incredibly close, and he helps her through sort of very difficult points, you know, having lost her brother and her mother in fairly quick succession. What was the inspiration for that relationship?
That was, my mum's foster father actually was quite like that, except he drank a lot more in real life than what the character did in the book. Yeah, it was based on that. Like, I remember some people at times have said they were just waiting for there to be some kind of darkness in that relationship, or, you know, like, or something of abuse, which sort of shows the time we live in now. But it was always just supposed to be a beautiful father and daughter relationship, which is, you know, just something that I think you hope for yourself as, you know, become a parent or something, that you'll have that relationship with your child or children. So now that was just something that my mum constantly talked about lovingly, and I wanted to express that in the book.
And I think Hans was possibly the character whom I liked the best out of all the characters in your book. It's difficult to ask an author to pick favourites with his characters, but if you had to choose one, who would you pick?
Oh, for me, my favourite character was always Rudy, just from the moment he painted himself black and became Jesse Owens. And that was just a gift given to me by doing research. And I wanted to research footballers from that time, thinking that the kids would play on the street and sort of imitate their heroes. And then I just saw a book about the Olympics, and I just thought of Jesse Owens immediately. And I just really liked that idea of a kid doing that and being sort of subversive in his own small way without even knowing it. And And from that moment, I loved him. And it's just so, it's just some little spark that you don't know is going to happen that turns out to be your best surprise.
And as we've said, this book has been hugely successful, internationally, in fact. Does that make it difficult to pick up your pen for the next novel?
Yeah, I think it gives you more reason to doubt yourself. And I think in this case, like, I just put in such an effort that I thought, I don't know if I can write a better book than this one. But now it's just a case of, like, I know I have to. And people will say, don't put any pressure on yourself to write a better book. Just write a different one. And I think, well, no, I've always wanted to write a better book. So why change that? You know, try to do what works, you know, or has worked in the past. So, I'm sort of struggling a bit, but I can still say it with a smile on my face. So, you know, that's just the way it has to be.
Can you tell us at all what the next book's about?
Yeah, it's about a bridge builder named Clay. So the book's called Bridge of Clay. And he's just obsessed with the idea of making something great and beautiful and to sort of transcend humanness in a way by building a bridge that he can maybe walk across when the river floods it. And the question is, will the bridge survive and will he drop into the water, or will he, you know, be able to walk all the way across? So, you know, we'll see what happens. If I can get past the first page, you know, it should all get better from there.
Okay, well, really good luck with it, and thanks very much for coming to talk to us.
No, thanks for having me.
Hello, I'm John Crace, and I'm looking through the window of the Tented Hay Festival press office. And there's a gaggle of PR girls inside, and not wanting to stereotype, I'm quite sure their day started hours ago. I can picture that one over there. Her alarm went off at 6 a.m. and she reluctantly dragged herself to the bathroom to attach her fixed grin. And then she practiced saying, "You're absolutely marvellous," for 2 hours until even she thought she was being sincere, and then headed off to the festival site to greet her first speaker of the day, Brian Kane, author of The Sunk Without Trace, How Worms Once Ruled the World. Brian is already here, easily identifiable by the nasty stains under his armpits and the stale halitosis. But she glides towards him, and after 10 minutes of small talk, Brian is confident that she really fancies him. She leads him towards the smallest venue where 17 people, 5 of them already asleep, are waiting. "Gosh," she says, "we've never had this many people here at 9 a.m. before." But Brian is on a roll now, delivering his well-rehearsed worm anecdotes with panache. And at the end of the hour, there is a polite smattering of applause. "How was I?" he asks. "Absolutely marvellous," she replies, relieved that her most difficult gig of the day is over. But look, the festival organiser is tapping her on the shoulder. Could she tell the overweight journalist from The Times, with the legendary overinflated ego, that his talk in the Barclays Wealth Pavilion has just been downgraded to a smaller venue because of low ticket sales? Her day has just got immeasurably worse.
I'm sitting here in the Askari tent with Fiona Miller, who has been discussing her book, The Secret World of the Working Mother. Fiona, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the book's a look at a number of issues that working mothers face, and it's sort of loosely based on my life, I think, but with a lot of interviews with other women woven into the story, because I found that my life was actually quite representative of what had happened to women once they have children, which is that they generally go part-time, lose pay and status, and become less equal than their partners, I think.
You yourself went back to work when your baby was 9 weeks old, did you say?
12 weeks old. He was 12 weeks old, yeah. Which seemed very generous in 1988, but of course now it seems an incredibly short time to have had at home with him. And I went back full-time to a very demanding job at the House of Commons. It was such an awful experience, actually, working full-time, especially working nights at the House of Commons with a small child. So I gave up, and I was very lucky to have quite enlightened employers at what was a very right-wing, illiberal institution in a way, socially conservative institution, the Daily Express, and they were desperate to keep me, and so they found me a series of part-time jobs that I could do, none of which was high profile as being a lobby correspondent, but it meant I could carry on working, and that saw me through the next 2 pregnancies one way or another. So I freelanced a bit and I went into the office a bit.
You're very honest about how it affected your relationship with your partner Alistair Campbell and how his career was not so affected as yours.
Well, I think we did take a conscious decision that it would be me that stopped. And I had no doubts about it at the time. And looking back, I probably wouldn't have had it any other way, because I loved all the things that I got out of that. I mean, I got to get to know my local community, and I became a governor at school, and so I felt I was half in and half out of both worlds. But I mean, looking back now, I can see that women do sacrifice much more in terms of being professionally fulfilled and in terms of keeping up when it comes to pay and promotion and status and so on.
I heard a report last week about women who don't have children being actually worse considered in the workplace than women who do have children now. Is that something that you've been aware of at all?
I don't think so. I think on the whole things have got better for women who have children, but I still think there are quite a lot of assumptions in the workplace about women, especially women who want to work flexibly. That, you know, there is an assumption that flexible work is associated with a lower commitment than somebody who works full time, for example. And I think that's something we've got to get over. And I don't think it'll really change, frankly, until more men start to ask to work flexibly. And then you'll start to see proper part-time, high-quality jobs that men and women can do.
Now, in a way, your book, because it's finished and written and published, is belongs to a past moment. The economy has been collapsing around us. How is that going to affect all the initiatives, the childcare initiatives, which are still unrolling?
I think in some ways, women might benefit. I mean, some women will have to go back to work, won't they, to shore up the family income if a man loses a job. But in other ways, I think women will be worried about asking for flexible work because they'll want to be seen to be visible in the office, and they'll be worried that if they do ask to go for part-time, theirs will be the job that goes.
So do you have any top tips for mothers about how you juggle family and work nowadays?
I think the most important one is to get the right childcare, because I think if you feel you're leaving your children with somebody who really cares about them and is providing a good, loving, stimulating environment, it's much easier to walk out the door in the morning, isn't it? So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say, based on my experience of having fully absorbed the dual burden of all the housework and childcare and a job at the same time, is try and share out the other tasks more equally right from the start. I think the difficulty is a lot of women take the maternity leave and they start doing all the kind of shopping and cleaning and cooking that is associated with children. And then when they go back to work, that pattern has been set. And then the dual burden is often the thing that's the tipping point, I think, for women to give up work altogether, because they just feel they're overwhelmed by the responsibilities.
You're talking from personal experience partly, yeah, there, aren't you? That do you feel that the work in your load in your family has been very unequal?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of it's to do with the conditioning. I mean, my mother was very much a kind of homemaker, but she did work as well, but she did all the homemaking too. And I slipped into that role very, very quickly and easily. And the three male members of my household, my partner and my two sons, well, one of them is better than the other, but two of them do absolutely nothing, and they're more than happy to wait for me, my mother, my son waits for his girlfriend to come around to do his washing. And it's, so I feel I've failed in that sense. And I think my other tip would be, if you've got sons, make sure that they grow up knowing how to use the washing machine and put the ironing board up.
Alistair's actually working from home now, isn't he? So there's no excuse for him not to fill the washing machine.
Well, I did once say to him, would he mind mowing the lawn? He said, if I wanted to mow the lawn, I'd have become a gardener.
That's all for today's Haycast. Tomorrow we'll be speaking to Roy Hattersley and visiting Arnold Wesker in his home nearby. I'm Claire Armistead, and this Haycast was produced by Francesca Panetta and Lucy Greenwell.